Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Middle East reset as Syria's Assad looks for an exit strategy from his government's brutal crackdown on protesters. President Obama looks to reset the role of the United States in the Middle East for the post-Bin Laden world. This breathtakingly historic year continues to unfold unpredictably in the region, with one of the most horrific bursts of government violence now underway in Syria, and President Obama figuring out new ways to fight extremism and increase U.S. influence after the death of Bin Laden. Just in from the AP, by the way, Obama is inviting anti-Gaddafi leaders from Libya to the White House for Friday. Let's see what's going on with two guests. First, Anthony Shadid, New York Times correspondent, covering Syria from Beirut. Anthony, welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello.
You have a long piece in the Times today about the crackdown in Syria and its implications, but the dateline is Beirut. So is the Syrian government restricting entry to journalists?
Yeah, they are, as a general policy, not letting foreign correspondents into Damascus. I was able to visit briefly this week, but it was only for several hours, about 6 hours in all. And although it gave a brief window on government thinking, you know, I wasn't able to get much further than the capital and the streets of the capital to see how the crackdown was faring elsewhere in the country.
How are you getting information?
Well, we're having to rely on third-hand accounts, second-hand accounts, activists abroad, people that we can reach by phone in towns and cities like Homs and Beni Yass. It's a frustrating experience, to say the least, and I think it's an incomplete picture when you get down to it. But, you know, at this point, it's probably as authoritative as we're going to get.
And still, you know enough, apparently, to call this one of the most brutal waves of repression since the Arab Spring began. But you also say Syrian President Assad sees the need to create an exit from the crisis to sustain his support among minorities, the middle class, and the business elite. So let's break that down. First, give us your best understanding of the extent of this moment of brutal repression.
Well, let me just go back, if I can, one step. I mean, the crackdown is the exit. How he's going to end this crisis is a crackdown, and he'll kill as many people and arrest as many people as his government needs to stop these protests from happening on successive Fridays. And there are, you know, some indications at this point that he may be able to do that. I mean, when we talk about the number of deaths, when we talk about the number of arrests, you know, granted, figures are going to probably be off by, you know, scores, even hundreds. But we're talking about one of the, you know, most, if not the most remarkable bout of repression that the region has witnessed in months and even years. On successive Fridays, protesters have been shot. We're dealing with an arrest campaign that's so broad at this point, people are being rearrested two or three times by competing security agencies. And if you get that, I mean, the kind of bizarre nature of that, you're picked up, you know, beaten, who knows what happens. You're released a few days later, then picked up again by somebody who doesn't know you were arrested in the first place. So, I mean, it's such a random, arbitrary campaign. It's meant, I mean, from what we can gather, it's meant for, you know, to do one thing, and that's to restore the sense of fear in the country that helped keep the government in place.
So if the crackdown is the exit strategy from the crisis of a protest, explain the rest of that sentence in your piece. If the crackdown is to sustain the government support among minorities, the middle class, and the business elite, how would the crackdown do that?
Well, you know, let's start with the business elite. And the business elite are going to be concerned first and foremost with instability. You can't do business in an unstable country. Foreign capital is going to leave the country. It's going to be hard to bring investment into the country. What the business elite needs in Syria is stability. And so the government, from their thinking at least, needs to prove that they can bring stability as soon as possible. And I think that's why you're seeing a campaign escalate as it has. They need to end this crisis now, and they need to end it because the economy is already starting to reel. And we have to remember here, I think the economy is an incredibly important factor in all this. The economic fallout from these protests may be more threatening to the regime than the protests themselves. So then if we take it a step further to minorities, I think minorities have that same sense of chaos, of anarchy. If this government falls, there's going to be a prolonged score settling, and that's something they don't want. And again, the government to kind of bolster, you know, perhaps flagging support among minorities to show that they can end this crisis, that they can restore stability. So what we're dealing with in some ways is the arithmetic of fear of the unknown, recreating fear inside the country that helped the government justify its rule, and fear, I think, also of countries abroad, namely the United States and Europe, of what might follow President Assad.
Anthony Shadid, New York Times Beirut Bureau Chief, with us talking about Syria and the Middle East Arab Spring in general. Listeners, you can get in on this, 212-433-WNYC. Any Syrian Americans listening? Anyone else? 212-433-9692. Or post your comment to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Also with us now is Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes a newsletter called Syria Comment. Joshua, welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Do you agree with Anthony Shadid's take, first of all, that President Assad is trying to use the crackdown as an exit strategy from the protest, and that he actually hopes to cultivate support in the middle class and business elites and minorities in this way?
Yes, I do. You know, he's caught in between two currents. One is the international community is under great pressure to do something. And we've seen both Europe and the United States have put sanctions on Syria. Now, these are targeted sanctions against individuals who, you know, their bank accounts, travel, so forth. That's not going to change anything. But the United States let out that it might declare the regime illegal. Now, if something like that happened, it would be really tough for this regime to come back. The other, as Anthony's pointed out, is the economy. Syria has a very weak economy. Everything is frozen. I've spoken to a few business people in the last few days, and they say, hotel owners say, we don't know whether to let go of the staff, just to close the doors. There is no, everybody's canceled. The tourist season, which is about 15% of the Syrian economy, outside currency, is dead. So is foreign investment. And Assad's plan for the future of Syria and his promise to sort of put a chicken in everybody's pot was to modernize the economy, get foreign investment, have a new infrastructure, roads, gas lines, and this was going to bring in money with opening up to the world. That vision of the future of Syria is in shambles. And if he cannot put down this Arab Spring and get back into the good graces of the international community, Syria faces a very bleak future.
All to keep his own family and himself in power?
You know, there is a very selfish motive to this and to the people around him. On the other hand, I'm sure he believes that Syria is a fragile, multi-ethnic, multi-sectarian society, and it could be like Lebanon or like Iraq. And we've seen, of course, every dictator has said the same thing. You know, after me, the Great Flood, and that it'll be chaos. And this regime has threatened that. So there is a very selfish aspect, but there is also this unknown that Anthony was talking about of what happens next, because the opposition is very disunited, is not united, and we don't know the leadership. So you're sort of stepping off into the unknown.
I see on your website, Syria Comment, that you have an interview today with Fidaldin Al-Fayyad Issa, who you call the administrator of the Facebook page, Syrian Revolution 2011. There's a Facebook page by that name?
Yes, there is, and it's been the most important one. It's got almost 200,000 members. They've been working in Sweden, a central page organizing demonstrations, setting up times, working over all the videos, the rough footage they get out from video phones and cameras, and putting them up, making montages, and pushing. They've dominated. The opposition has dominated the media flow out of Syria, and they have shaped this around freedom, anti-tyranny, democracy, and the end of corruption. So they have been very successful in shaping their demands, and this webpage has been at the center of that.
Anthony Shadid from the New York Times, in your article today, you contrast the role of the army in Egypt and Tunisia, where they navigated the transition in one way, compared to all these more violent situations taking place now in Syria, Libya, Bahrain, and Yemen. Not to forget that hundreds of Egyptians were killed by police during Tahrir Square. But what are you comparing exactly?
Well, Well, I think just the role, the relationship with the military to the state, I think, or the government or the regime, or how we want to describe it. And I mean, I defer to Josh on this, who's far, you know, far more of an expert. But, you know, my sense of that in Egypt and Tunisia, you had a not, I wouldn't maybe even say semi-independent necessarily, but you had an institution like the military in both countries that was able to exert enough independence at the climactic moment to actually offer a transition, to offer a way forward, you know, after the dictator was to fall, in the case of, you know, Mr. Mubarak in Egypt or Mr. Ben Ali in Tunisia. You don't get that sense in Syria, at least with the elite units, when we talk about the Republican Guard or the 4th Division, and more importantly, I think the intelligence services, those are tightly knit into the structure of the government, and that's a government that operates along the lines of clan and family loyalty. So you really, we keep hearing reports about defections here and there, but they seem to be low level. They seem to be conscripts. It's hard to gauge how extensive they actually are. But I think when you talk about the key forces that are loyal to the regime, the elite units that I mentioned, and more importantly, the intelligence services, there's no sense of fissure there at this point.
John, do you agree? We certainly saw the defections in the Egyptian army from Mubarak. I think people have been expecting Gaddafi's military to turn on him in Libya more than they have. Do you see the army as an institution that could flip in Syria?
No, it can't. And that's because of the sectarian, deep sectarian differences in Syria. The Alawite community, about 12% of the country, dominate the top of the military structure. They dominate the Mukhabarat, the intelligence units. The Republican Guard, 10,000 strong, led by the president's brother, is all Alawite. If these people turn on their president and they divide amongst themselves, they're all going to lose their jobs. The Egyptian army could turn on their president, and they knew that whoever came next would all hire them all back. Maybe, you know, five or six are going to be prosecuted. But the Syrian army would crumble. The Ba'ath Party, 1.5 million people, is going to be eliminated. This could mean 2 million people lose their jobs. We saw this in Iraq when the de-Ba'athification came on, when the Shiites took over from the Sunnis. They were wiped out. And that's what people fear in Syria. This isn't just the president and a few people around him. This is a big revolutionary change when it comes.
Joshua Landis writes the newsletter Syria Comment at the University of Oklahoma. Anthony Shadid reports for the New York Times in Beirut. And John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Anthony, I believe earlier this week, did a piece on Rami Maklouf, who's the President Assad's cousin, probably the most powerful businessman in Syria. And in the interview, it says that the interview was about 3 hours long. Unfortunately, there was just so little, because of space constraints, we only got a few quotes from him. And I wanted, could the Times post that interview or a good chunk of it? Because, I mean, he's one of the most powerful people in the country. We'd get a lot more information about his thinking and the regime's thinking. But, I mean, one thing that he said that I thought that was odd, I mean, he says if there's no stability here, there's no way there will be stability in Israel. No way, and nobody can guarantee what will happen after, God forbid, anything happens to this regime. And it just seems kind of incongruous for him to just kind of randomly raise the issue of Israel when this hasn't been about, well, I mean, I'm
Right. It hasn't primarily been about the United States or Israel in any of these countries. So, Anthony, interesting question from John.
Well, let me start off the first part of it. You know, John, it's interesting. They did not let me tape record the interview, so it was a handwritten transcript. I mean, I was taking notes, and it did go on, like you pointed out, for 3 hours. But you know, it was a 11-team conversation, which means there was plenty of small talk. So, you know, I think I can see the frustration. I actually think that the article addressed the key points of what he said. I'm sure scholars and people interested parties would like to hear more, but a lot of it was variations, to be honest, on what he said in the points that I tried to cover in the story. You know, the Israel thing, I think, is when we look at where the Syrian government, I mean, what the Syrian government sees as its legitimacy at this point is almost kind of a negative legitimacy. In other words, if we go, there's going to be instability. If we go, there's going to be chaos, and everyone better be aware of that. And I asked Rami Maklouf very, you know, pointedly, I said, you know, is that a threat or a warning? And he demurred. I mean, he did not want to answer that question, but it was clear that this is their, in a way, their cry for help. If you don't protect us, if you you don't save us, look what we're going to unleash. And I think that has to do with Israel, that has to do with Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey. I mean, I think it's a message they're sending to all their neighbors at this point, that we're the best you can do at this. We're the best you can do right now.
Sabir, Syrian-American in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sabir. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay. What's up?
I want to make a comment about Mr. Shadid's. He said, there is a possibility for the government to continue its crackdown on people to stop the demonstrators from doing that. And I don't think it's possible. I think, taking into consideration the makeup of the Syrian culture, which is, there is a lot of the fact that people have revenge as part of their culture and. And also that they don't trust the government, that once the demonstrations stop, that the government or the regime would actually not take them one by one and torture them or keep them in prison. And the other comment also is the conflict is pretty much isolated. It's not the region and the Americans or the Europeans, they don't really have lots of pressure on Syria, and the. It's pretty much it's pretty much the people against the regime, and I think it's going to continue, and there's only one way for this to go, and it's going to just continue and grow bigger.
Thank you for your call, Sabir. And Anthony, I think we see it in country after country where political analysts and outside experts see the strength of these regimes. Insiders, we saw it in Iran now for 2 years, say, okay, maybe not this week, maybe not this month, but eventually this is going to fall.
Well, I think the caller is exactly right, and I think your point is well taken. I mean, in some ways, what this uprising has represented is the weakness of this regime, of a regime that has focused on Damascus and Aleppo at the expense of the countryside. There's deep disenchantment out there, and we're seeing this, in some ways, as a movement of dispossessed. I mean, the towns on the outskirts of Damascus, which are poor, places in the countryside that have been stricken by drought for 5 years, and I think the caller makes a very good point also that what happens when the tanks withdraw from cities like Homs, Benias, and Deraa. There is an incredible amount of discontent out there. And it's a point I tried to make in earlier stories, is that the uprising is now gaining its own symbols of legitimacy, symbols that weren't there previously. The mistreatment, the torture, this is going to be remembered. And as one American official put it to me last week, there are people who are going to be joining these protests who would have never joined them in the first place. So I think there is absolutely a new dynamic in Syria that did not exist there before, an earth-shattering dynamic in the Syrian context. The government is not thinking about that long term, though. It's thinking about the short term, and it's in survival mode. And when you're in survival mode, you're thinking about how do we stop this tomorrow and the day after and the next Friday. I think that's their mindset at this point.
And the caller asked about the role of the United States and the lack of outside pressure on the Syrian regime. Josh, you posted on your website an AP story from Tuesday, headlined U.S. Closer to Declaring Assad's Rule in Syria Illegitimate. And it starts, the U.S. is edging closer to calling for an end to the long rule of the Assad family in Syria. Obama administration officials say the first step would be to declare for the first time that President Bashar Assad has forfeited his legitimacy to rule. So do you think President Obama will do that? And if he does, so what? What does Assad care?
Well, I think he would care a lot, because it would mean very difficult to reestablish yourself in the community. But I don't think the West is going to do that, because the fear here is that should Syria fall into civil war like Iraq or Lebanon, there is no alternative military structure to step in. Nobody wants another failed state, particularly in the center of the Middle East. If there were 4 million refugees, as there were in Iraq, where are they going to go? They're going to go stampeding into Lebanon and particularly Turkey, where there is no visa requirement anymore, and they're going to go to Europe. Just in the last 3 days, three students in America, Syrian students in America, have written to and called me to ask for help in getting political refugee status in the United States. That's the beginning of the wave. There is going to be a big wave of refugees coming out of this country. And Syrians have relatives in France and Canada, United States. They're going to be stampeding towards these countries, and nobody wants that. What is the alternative? That's what everybody is asking. Who is going to take power?
Josh, are you unhappy that the United Nations and the international community generally kind of played their hand in Libya by sending in the military and devoting so many resources now in a way that probably freezes them from doing anything nearly as significant in Syria, which might be a more important country?
You know, the West doesn't have a good solution, as your callers have pointed out. Nobody's going to send an army into Syria. Syria is 23, 24 million people. It's the size of Iraq. We already saw what happened to America and Iraq. If one of these countries goes, it's a big affair, and only the country will be able to put it back together again. Nobody is going to do what America mm-hmm. did in Iraq again. That's finished.
So before you both go, let me just play one clip of President Obama from his announcement that Osama bin Laden had been killed a week and a half ago now, and ask if you think this has implications for a changing United States role with respect to Syria or the region at all, because another Times article today, Anthony, describes how President Obama's family experiences in Kenya and Indonesia taught him the limits of U.S. power to influence corrupt governments in the developing world, but that he is apparently planning some kind of post-Bin Laden address to global Muslims for next week. And here is the president seeming to get ready for this as he announced Bin Laden's death.
We must and we will remain vigilant at home and abroad. As we do, we must also reaffirm that the United States is not and never will be at war with Islam. I've made clear, just as President Bush did shortly after 9/11, that our war is not against Islam. Bin Laden was not a Muslim leader. He was a mass murderer of Muslims. Indeed, al-Qaeda has slaughtered scores of Muslims in many countries, including our own. So his demise should be welcomed by all who believe in peace and human dignity.
So, Anthony Shadid, do you think we're going to hear more talk like that from the president next week? And how does it relate to the U.S. policy toward the Arab Spring?
Well, I think we are going to hear more from President Obama. And I think in an American context, it's incredibly important. It is a legacy of 9/11. It's a legacy that's still playing itself out. I think when you talk about the Arab world, there is kind of a collective shrug of the shoulders in the Arab world. Bin Laden was never perhaps as relevant to Arabs as he was to Americans. That might be difficult to understand.
He came out of Saudi Arabia as a violent, opponent of the Saudi regime, no?
He came out of Saudi Arabia, went to Afghanistan, which is quite a ways from the heart of the Arab world. And I think, it did in some ways dominate the narrative for America of its relationship with the Arab world, but it by no means dominated the Arab world's narrative of itself. And I think the Arab Spring is the climactic, almost definitive epitaph to any role or any influence Bin Laden might have had inside the Arab world itself. I'm not trying to dismiss Bin Laden's phenomenon by any means, but the Arab world is gripped by a dynamic here that is revolutionary, almost unprecedented, perhaps one of the most remarkable movements in modern Arab history. And that dynamic has absolutely overwhelmed anything that Bin Laden represented.
Josh, do you think the president can use the death of Bin Laden to reset the U.S.'s role, either in the Arab world or in the Muslim world, which is not identical?
I do. And I think he will focus on just what Anthony is talking about, which is the Arab Spring signifies a rejection of Bin Ladenism and extremism and in Iranianism. It is what we have seen is the embracing of people power, not an elite terrorist organization, embracing democracy, embracing coalition building. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Syria and so forth has rushed to the center to embrace a larger coalition that's included Christians. And we saw that in Tahrir Square. We saw that in Syria. There's an attempt by the mainstream Islamist organizations to choose democracy, coalition building, and so forth. Now, a lot of people don't trust this will last, and we've seen Salafis and other Islamists attack Christians in Egypt. So there's still a lot of fear that this is, a political ploy. But on the other hand, there has been the Arab Spring stands for everything that is not Bin Laden. It stands for politics taking, Bin Laden tried to destroy America, going for the far enemy, thinking that America was the puppet master of all these regimes, and that if you could destroy America, the regimes would fall. The Arab Spring is proving that you can turn over your own governments if you unite as a people.
Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes an online newsletter called Syria Comment. Anthony Shadid is the Beirut bureau chief for The New York Times. Thank you both so much for this very informative conversation.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, the changing role of gay conservatives in the Republican Party. Stay with us.